My name is Tyler Stockton. I'm the president of the student chapter of the Federalist Society here.
And
myself, along with Lars Phillips, the president of the American Constitution Society, and our faculty advisor, Professor Anthony Johnstone, are delighted to have each and every one of you here with us tonight. Tonight, we have all four candidates for the two open seats on the Montana Supreme Court here to answer questions in a forum setting. They are David Herbert, Justice Mike Wheat, Justice Jim Rice, and former Montana Solicitor General Lawrence Van Dyke. Justice Rice is running against Mr. Herbert, and Justice Wheat is running against former Solicitor General Van Dyke. Please join me in welcoming each of them to the University of Montana School of Law. This forum will be set up in rounds of 12 minutes apiece. There will be an opening slash introduction period where each candidate has 3 minutes to give their opening remarks. That will be followed by 5 questions given by Professor Johnstone, where each candidate will have 3 minutes to respond as well. Each candidate will then have 3 minutes at the end for closing statements. They will begin, we drew hats earlier, drew names earlier from a hat, and they will begin in a random order and will change as we go through the questions this evening. Finally, this event is an opportunity to hear the candidates. You might have particular candidates you support or appreciate more. Please refrain from applauding or commenting in any manner until the event has completed. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to add my welcome to Tyler's, to welcome to the University of Montana School of Law, the Academic Legal Center of Montana, as we call it. And I would also like to thank Tyler and Lars and Montana student chapters of the Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society for sponsoring this event. And thank, again, all of you for joining us. The order that the students drew lots for that determines the candidate's order presentation will rotate, starting with Mr. Van Dyke, then Mr. Herbert, then Justice Rice, and then Justice Wheat. First, as Tyler said, we'll provide you each 3 minutes to introduce yourselves and provide opening statements, starting with Mr. Van Dyke. 3 minutes.
Well, thank you guys very much for having me. This is a very loud mic. All right. This is great to be here. It's great to see so many people. You know, one of the things that I was frustrated about before I was a lawyer was voting for judges, not knowing anything about them. So at least, 200 people or something will know something about the judges after we're done here, and hopefully more than that with it being televised. And so I want to tell you a little bit about my background. I grew up in Montana. I'm a fifth generation Montanan. My dad had an irrigation business in the Gallatin Valley, and I grew up in that, and I went to Montana State University. I know that's a remember he said no booing. But I was engineering major there, so there's no engineering here. So that's my excuse for having gone to that and having grown up in Bozeman. But I did that and then got a master's in engineering and then worked in my dad's company for some years doing construction projects around the state, including here in Missoula. And then kind of took the law school exam on a lark, or the LSAT, and got into Harvard Law School. Got a scholarship to go there. I had 2 kids at the time, so we kind of packed up the family, much to my poor wife's chagrin, and drug her all the way to Boston. So that started a trip where I went to Harvard Law School for 3 years, was in law review, graduated with honors there, and so had an opportunity to work in D.C., clerked for a federal appellate judge in D.C. for a year, which is a fantastic job, and then worked for... After that, I worked in D.C. and in Dallas for a top appellate and constitutional litigation shop doing that around the country. So that's what I did until General Fox got elected, and we were dying to come back to Montana, wanted to get the kids back here. So I was able to get a job with him as the state solicitor general, as Anthony's successor and the top appellate and constitutional litigator in the Attorney General's office. So that's my background. I've been, for about a decade, I've been an appellate and constitutional litigator. I think that's sort of a diverse and different background to bring. One of the issues we have in Montana is we don't have multiple tiers of appellate courts. We only have the Montana Supreme Court, unlike most other states. Because of that, it's difficult to have somebody who spent their whole career working on appellate and constitutional issues, which is what I've done for almost a decade. So that's kind of what I would like to try to bring to Montana and bring to the Supreme Court. And that's, I I guess it. 30 seconds left, Your Honor.
Mr. Herbert.
My name is Dave Herbert. On the ballot, I'm W. David Herbert. I was born in Salinas, California in April of 1943. I grew up in the southern Salinas Valley on our family farm and ranch, and we had cattle and we had sugar beets. And I remember we had a big tin building out there. It was probably the size of a small barn. And when I was about 6 years old, I was out there with my grandfather, and he said, David, do you know what I put in there? No, I don't know what you put in there. What did you put in there? Grandpa said, I put Jerry's farm equipment, some of his tractors, and some of his furniture in there before they sent Jerry off to a concentration camp. Jerry was a good friend of my grandfather's. He had been for many years. He was a strawberry farmer. He was an American citizen, but his problem was he was Japanese. And then my grandfather told me, not only did they send him to a concentration camp, but they passed a law saying that if I did this, if I did that, if I'd helped him, I could go to jail. He called it jail because I wouldn't have understood prison probably then. And I remember standing there saying, my goodness, why would anybody send my grandfather to jail for helping Jerry? I knew Jerry. He was a very, very nice man. And that's when I first learned in this country that not all laws are fair and just. And I also read a few years later, our second president, John Adams, said, a jury has the right not to enforce an unjust law. They not only have the right to not enforce an unjust law, but they have the duty and the responsibility to not enforce an unjust law. That is one of the issues of my campaign. As far as other background goes, I graduated from California State University of Chico in 1965. I was a pre-veterinary major. I didn't get into UC Davis Veterinary School, so I ended up flying in the Air Force. I flew the F-4 Phantom jet in combat in 1969 to 70 in Vietnam, and when I returned, I was a lucky recipient of a medical military scholarship, and I got my Doctor of Pediatric Medicine degree from Kent State University in 1976. I have been a licensed podiatrist, a foot specialist in the military, we basically are surgeons, since 1976. I still have an active license in Wyoming. I have recently been a lawyer since June of 1987. In law school, at the University of Pacific McGeorge School of Law, I was very fortunate to have Anthony Kennedy. You may have heard of him. He's on the U.S. Supreme Court. A very gentle man, a humble man, but a very, very smart man. And that's my background, and that's basically my story.
Justice Rice.
Thank you, Anthony, and good evening, everyone. First, I just want to thank the Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society for making this event possible tonight. Appreciate their involvement. Appreciate your involvement in being here. To the other candidates, I just want to say it's good to see you guys also again and again and again and again throughout the course of the campaign. I've been privileged to have worked in lifelong service in the state of Montana. Really from one of my first jobs, my first state job. I took flight training when I was in high school, received my pilot's license when I was 17 years old, and then went to work for the state of Montana as a member of a HeliTAC quick response crew fighting wildfires for the DNRC. And that was the most action-packed service I've ever given to the state of Montana. I received my education here in Montana. I attended law school here at the U of M, during which time I interned at the Missoula City Attorney's Office under City Attorney Jim Nugent. Jim Nugent is still the city attorney in Missoula. I think he's moved up to the status of institution at this point since I worked for him of over 35 years ago. Upon graduation, I was a public defender in Lewis and Clark County for 4 years and obtained a lot of valuable trial experience in a very short period of time. Thereafter, I practiced law in Helena for 19 years, representing individuals and small businesses. And during that time, I was elected to 3 terms in the Montana legislature and was selected to the leadership of the House of Representatives. Upon leaving the legislature, I was appointed by the governor as the chair and presiding officer of the State Board of Personnel Appeals, which is the quasi-judicial body that hears and decides collective bargaining disputes in the public defender, and served in that position for 5 years before going to the court in 2001, and I've been on the court for the past 13 and a half years. I'm now one of the senior justices on the Montana Supreme Court, and during the time I have served there, we have seen significant advances in the manner in which the court decides cases and the promptness with which we decide them. The court is caught up on its cases. We've implemented case management performance measures that has speeded the process of decision. We have no backlog. You don't wait a long time for a decision from the Montana Supreme Court. There are no delays. All in all, this sums up a 35-year career of service to the people of Montana, and particularly with regard to analysis and application of Montana law. I've been cited, my opinions have been cited twice by the U.S. Supreme Court with regard to decisions that they have made, and I'll close my opening with a quote on another case by a leading Montana newspaper, and I think sums up my career in the court. Jim Rice's closely reasoned 34-page opinion is a model of letting the law and not ideology determine the outcome.
Justice Wheat.
Thank you, Anthony. Boy, you timed that just right, Jim. The buzzer went off and you were done. Good evening. I also want to thank the law school for putting this event on, and it's really good to be here. It's good to see some of my old friends and some of you I've worked with at the court. Some of you I know will be coming to the court in the future. I want to talk a little bit about my background, but I don't want us to forget what this race is really all about. And we can sit here and we can talk about our backgrounds and all that nice stuff, but really what this race is about is it's about what's going to happen in this race. It's about how our court may be under attack from out-of-state money, from out-of-state corporations who want to come into the state and influence who's going to be on the court. Now, I think that's really important in this race, and it's really important for the future of the court, and so it's important for you to take a look at the candidates that are running, what they stand for, and what their background is. Now, with that, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I started my life in Superior, Montana. I suppose most of you know where that is. It's about 60 miles west of here. My father worked in the woods, and he worked in the Diamond Match Sawmill. He was also a custodian at the school. And when I was about 10 years old, my dad picked up his family and moved to Nevada looking for work. That's where I finished school. And in Nevada, my dad worked construction, and he also worked at the Nevada test site. It was in Nevada after I graduated from high school that I ended up in the United States Marine Corps. And I served in Vietnam as a combat soldier in 68 and 69. After I returned from Vietnam, I helped my folks move back to Montana. My dad actually was born on a homestead in Mill Iron, Montana. Is there anybody in this room who knows what Mill Iron, Montana is? I can tell you, it's a little northeast of Ekalaka. It's not a place that I think you want to settle. Anyway, I helped my folks move back to Montana, and they settled in the Whitehall area, and I started school at Montana State. The most important part about that is that's where I met my wife. My wife and I have now been married for 41 years. We both moved to Missoula in 1973 after we married, because we both got our undergraduate degree and our graduate degrees here. I graduated from the law school in 1978. Boy, that went fast. I'll finish up with that later. But thank you all for being here.
Well, thank you. Tonight, we'll give Montanans a perspective on your approaches to judging. And to do that, we'll use the lens of some broad themes expressed in the Montana Constitution. These aren't test questions or anything like that, but they're to help frame some of the issues that are before us these days. And let me start right off with Article 7, Section 8, which is about this right here, how you are selected to your jobs. Supreme Court justices shall be elected by the qualified electors as provided by law. The Constitution also incorporates the Code of Judicial Conduct that prohibits a judicial candidate from seeking, accepting, or using partisan or other political endorsements. 2 weeks ago, six of the seven sitting Supreme Court justices filed a brief defending this ethical rule against a constitutional challenge brought in federal court. They urged the court to acknowledge that regardless of what a political organization is allowed to do, a candidate for judicial office may and should be held to a standard commensurate with the dignity, gravity, and optimal function of the judicial office. So our first question is, first, would you have supported that brief? And second, how do you reconcile the political demands of campaigning for elective office and fundraising with the judicial demands of independence, integrity, and impartiality? Mr. Herbert will go first.
If I were not able to run for the Supreme Court in an election process, I would never be elected. I would never be appointed to any court. People of my background usually aren't appointed, and people of my background, my personality, usually do not seek political favors from politicians. In fact, I don't even like most politicians. So I have not received any. I've received one or two contributions that weren't my own. I have not received anything from out of state. I don't expect to, and I never will. I've received very little money. And therefore, I think that's the way to go. I don't know. But I haven't even checked to see what the other candidates have received. If you want somebody with true diversity like I have, I've been in combat for my country. I've served my country. I retired from the military as a lieutenant colonel, as a podiatrist. And I've worked as a podiatrist for many years. I've also tried 30 cases in five different states as a lawyer before juries. I've testified as a medical expert in at least three states, and I'll talk about that later. I think I'll be answering the question. But as far as parties go, I'm a libertarian. I ran as a libertarian in Wyoming twice, and I'm a Ron Paul type supporter. That's my politics. I'll be very, very honest with you. I'm a very constitutionally oriented person. I believe we should follow the Constitution. And ever since Marbury versus Madison, if you read my website, which is F4Dave, F4Justice.com, you will see how constitutionally oriented I am. Again, that's not political. I think that's a patriotic American approach to things. And I believe that there are too many people, two different parties, who forget exactly who we are as Americans. We're not great because of democracy. Democracy is not sacred. Vox populi is not vox dei. In other words, the voice of the people is not the voice of God. I learned that in Catholic school in the sixth or seventh grade, or maybe it was first year Latin class. I can't remember. But it was taught to me by a bunch of religious people who are basically from Italy. They said the greatest thing about your country here, and your greatest privilege is your constitution. It protects the minorities. It protects your religious rights. It protects your other inalienable rights. And again, I have not accepted and will not accept any contributions from any people who are not constitutionally oriented. Therefore, I have very, very few contributions to report. And I think it's, I like the idea that the judiciary is independent. And all of us have life experiences. We can't be that independent. But I'm telling you where I'm coming from, and that's probably what you should know. As an electorate, you're like kind of like being on my jury. I want full disclosure. I put my law school transcript on my internet site 5 months ago. I'd like to see other people do that too. That's something you can compare us on. We all went to law school.
Justice Rice.
In answer to the first part of your question, Anthony, yes, I would join the brief because I did in fact join the brief. And I think it's consistent with a concern the court has held over the past several years about some of the disturbing trends that are developing on the horizon with regard to judicial elections. And of course, our court, in a case you may remember, Anthony, Western tradition, Anthony argued the case, but with the Attorney General, as I recall, yeah. But we actually upheld Montana's longstanding legislative enactment, which prohibited the involvement of corporations in financing campaigns in Montana. And we did so with a good faith on several pronouncements the U.S. Supreme Court had made about the special need of judicial elections to be remain uninfluenced by corporations. And we thought with regard to those statements, we had room enough, given our state's long history of corporate dominance, that we had the opportunity within the law in good faith to uphold our statute. Well, it took the U.S. Supreme Court about 15 seconds to disagree, and despite the pronouncements it had made about the careful need to protect judicial elections, they overturned our decision and struck down our statute consistent with Citizens United. But that history demonstrates, I think, the court's concern, and the court's concern is, and my concern, is a reflection of, you know, the populist heritage that we have had in this state, which led up to the adoption of the provision for election of judges in Montana. We've always had suspicion historically in our state against the power brokers and against the backroom deal makers who make decisions with regard to who will serve where. And we wanted to open up that process to the sunshine, to the light, and have the people of Montana make those decisions. And that's our history, and that's really the reason why we have election of judges. And I've always supported that. And you can certainly argue back and forth between the appointment process and the election process about which one is least tainted by politics. But I've always liked elections because of what it does to me as a candidate. I have to go down to the county fair and I have to look people in the eye and hand out my brochure and ask people for support, and it reminds me who my bosses are. That said, I think given the very disturbing developments on the horizon, I think we'll be looking in the days ahead about whether that remains a good system given the possibility for corruption in the system or dominance by corporate interests. So we'll be looking at that in the days ahead.
Justice Weed.
I agree with everything that Justice Rice just said. Maybe that's why we get along so well on the court. And I do want to correct one thing that was said earlier. Justice Rice and I are the incumbents. We're on the court now. And so Mr. Van Dyke and Mr. Herbert are running against us. just to fill in a little bit about and follow up with what Justice Rice was saying, I too like the election process. And there are some states that have appointment. There's, I think, 38 that have elections. But it is this worry about money that's going to invade the process and overwhelm the process. And if you haven't seen the news articles about how this is happening around the country, then you're just simply not paying attention, because it is going on. And let me just read you one article or a statement out of the New York Times, which was an August 5, 2014 edition, and it said, "The Republican State Leadership Committee, a national group, plans to spend at least $5 million on judicial races this year in places like North Carolina, where more than half of the state's Supreme Court seats are on the ballot. They are also closely following races in Michigan, Montana, New Mexico, Ohio, and Texas." Now, this is not me. These are reporters for a national publication. And there are other examples. If you paid attention to the recent Supreme Court races in the state of Tennessee, there was millions of dollars that poured into that race. In Tennessee, they're appointed, and so the three judges were up for a retention election. And they ended up having to raise over $1 million, and money from outside the state, over $1 million came in. And that's what's going to start happening around our country. And the problem with that is that it starts pecking away at what we all want from our judiciary, which is fair, independent, and impartial justice. That's the hallmark of our judiciary in this state and around the country. And so we have to be vigilant in paying attention to what's going to be coming into the state. It's very, very important. And with that, reserve the rest of my time.
Mr. Van Dyke.
I wish I had done that. So I, too, am a fan of judicial elections. Maybe it's from growing up here in Montana, but I like the fact that judges are accountable to the people. Judges have to have a certain amount of independence, but you know, judges have it long term. Once you decide who's going to be your judge, we're going to be your justice for 8 years. So that creates a certain amount of independence. So I like the way the Montana's judiciary setup, the main issue is that people are informed when they go to vote. As somebody who's running, who has no political background at all, I've never worked on a campaign. If you look at my background, I have zero political background as far as having been a politician, working on a campaign, very few donations even to politicians, a fairly sizable one to my former boss, Tim Fox, but mostly that's about it. As somebody who did that, the biggest issue is information. It costs money to have information in races. I want to make sure that everybody knows I'm not asking for any partisan endorsements, but I do believe in the free speech rights of organizations to be able to speak on what they believe. I think it's a huge problem when you start telling people what they can and can't say. You know, we talked about a disturbing trend, talked about power brokers, backroom deal makers. Does anybody know how much money was spent by the Trial Lawyers Association in Justice Nelson's race 10 years ago? $300,000 within the last couple weeks. Does anybody know who was winning in the primary? Youngkin. Does anybody know who won? Nelson. It's not a new trend. The issue is just whether or not money, it's the issue is whether or not the trial lawyers are going to be the only people spending money. They spent $300,000. I do want you to pay attention. Pay attention to how much money the trial lawyers are going to spend. They already sued me to get me thrown off the ballot. That was Justice Sweet's supporters. The trial lawyers sued me to get me thrown off the ballot. I think that was the cheap alternative to win this race. So if you want to talk about deal makers and backroom deals, it's been that way for a long time. The last thing I'll say is I would not have joined that brief. And the reason is I am very skeptical. When somebody comes to you and says, we need to shut down speech or we need to shut down some money, you should have the same reaction when somebody comes up to you and says, hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. Be very, very skeptical. Usually it's very self-serving. This brief that was filed, we have three of the justices are former partisan officials. They have already, the main argument in the brief that they filed saying that you should not be able to accept partisan endorsements is that, oh, that's going to ruin it because they're going to, we won't be able to cleanse that taint. If that's really true, then a fortiori, you can't cleanse the taint of having been a partisan official for years. I mean, these arguments are, I think, self-serving. I don't think they're principled, and I think they're kind of results-oriented. I'll get into that more in next time.
We'll turn now to Article 3, Section 1, which discusses a separation of powers. Unlike the federal constitution, our constitution says something about it. The power of the government of the state is divided into three distinct branches, legislative, executive, and judicial. And no person or persons charged with the exercise of power properly belonging to one branch shall exercise any power properly belonging to either of the others. In so many words, it means that justices may exercise only the judicial power and may not, as we might put it, legislate from the bench. Now, in all of your campaigns, each of you proclaim that your legal judgment as a judge is independent of personal political beliefs as a citizen and voter. Can you provide an example of a specific case in which you took a position that you opposed personally because the law required it? Justice Rice.
I think one of the most obvious examples of that for me is a case in which I wrote the majority opinion of the court and then wrote a concurrence to my own opinion in which I disagreed with the outcome of the case, or I guess disagree with the law. The case was, the name of the plaintiff was Wiard, W-I-A-R-D, I think it's a 2003 or 4 case, workers' comp case, in which the legislature had passed some restrictions with regard to the timing on filing a work comp claims that eliminated Wiard's ability to file his claim. And so I wrote the opinion for the court. We applied the statute, and we said your claim is late. You can't obtain benefits. And then I wrote a concurrence that said the result of our decision today is stark. It is harsh and unfair. Because of the legislature's effort to eliminate lawyers from the system, you have a lot of unrepresented claimants now trying to navigate their own way through the system. And then on top of that, you have very strict time requirements for the filing of claims. And as a result of that, here we have a legitimate injury with legitimate medical benefits that is procedurally barred from proceeding and collecting payment. And I mean, there was no constitutional challenge to the statute. It was just apply it as is, and so we applied the statute. And I wrote the concurrence, and it was joined by Justice Nelson and Justice Leapart, I believe. But I think that illustrates in black and white a situation that what we really have to do sometimes, and that is that to set aside what we would normally think is a good outcome or what we would like to have in pursuant to our own sense of justice, and we apply the law as it's given to us. And I guess that's what special concurrences are for. Sometimes you get to express your opinion about it.
Justice Wheat.
You know, I can't think of a specific case, but what I can tell you, I've been on the court now for almost 5 years. And I also served in the legislature like Jim did. I served on the Senate side. And when I was in the legislature, I was elected as a partisan. But the minute I took my oath on the Supreme Court, I swore that I would uphold the Constitution. And every day when I am working on cases on the court, I set aside any what you might call partisan beliefs that I might have, and I decide the cases with my fellow justices on the basis of the facts that are brought to us and the law that is argued to us. That's our job. That's our obligation as justices, upholding the obligations that we obligated ourselves to abide by when we got on the court. I can assure you that I'm a human being that is a product of all of my experiences in life, but I'm not a machine. And so as a product of all my experiences in life, I set aside those experiences that I've had in life have helped me. They give me wisdom and they help me make decisions. But again, those decisions are made within the confines of the law and the facts. You know, in the legislature, you go in and you talk about policy and you have big arguments and you get on the floor and you talk about this and you talk about that. You have all kinds of deal making going on. That does not happen in the court. We are confined by the Constitution, statutes, and the facts of the case that we're dealing with. And one more thing about the court. There can be accusations thrown around all about any individual justice, but we get together as a group, that is, on the court, and we make collective decisions. For example, if I have an opinion, if I'm selected to write a proposed opinion, I send that around to my fellow justices, and they make their comments, they can suggest changes, and the final product is a product of the courts, not of mine or any individual justice.
Mr. Van Dyke.
So it's forbidden for judges to give, under the Judicial Code of Ethics, it's forbidden for justices or judges to give contributions to partisan candidates. Justice Wheat gave a contribution to Frankie Wilmer, Democrat candidate from Bozeman, after he was appointed to the bench.
My wife did.
Well, it was.
Go check it out. Name. I corrected it. It's okay. Taken care of.
So.
We'll get it straight.
Well, the report said Justice Wheat.
We'll read it. You'll see what it says.
Okay. As far as specific cases, I can't talk about any specific cases because I was a private attorney. You know, I was attorney for my entire career so far. And if I was to talk about cases and say, you know, this is the case I worked on, but I didn't like it, you know, they could go back to the client and the client could say, I didn't get a good deal on that or something. So it doesn't really, I think it would be unethical for me to talk about current cases and say, either when I was a state's attorney or when I was in private practice and say, you know, this is what I argued, but I didn't really think it was a good argument. I will say this, though. I will say that I did work on cases when I was working for the state and when I was in private practice where I didn't agree with either arguments or the ultimate result that would happen if I won. And the reason I did that was because that was my job. I was an advocate for my clients and I was an advocate for the state. It was my job to defend the laws of the state, and that's what I did. And you'll see that I think I did a good job of defending those laws, whether I agree with them or not. I put aside my own personal views and defended the law. And that's exactly what I'll do as a judge. It is your job to put aside your own personal views and defend the law, regardless of any personal preferences. As far as the hardest case, I guess as you might expect, the hardest case that I've had in my career was when I got sued by Justice Sweet supporters, the trial lawyers, to get me thrown off the ballot. When you get skin in the game, it makes the case pretty hard. And I had a lot of skin in that game. If I'd lost that case, there's a very good chance I would have had to pay their attorney's fees. So this gets to be very personal. But the biggest thing I was concerned about in that case was results-oriented judging, exactly the reason I'm running. And that is, I knew that there were some judges and justices who probably liked my opponent very much. My dad played racquetball with Mike and liked him. They rebel. I think he's a very likable guy. And I was very concerned that they would want to twist the law to try to get to a certain result. It very much came home to me in that case and many other cases I did in the Solicitor General's office. Results-oriented judging is when you pick the result you want and then you write an opinion to get there. And that's exactly why I'm running. We need to have judges who are 100% committed to applying the law as it expresses the will of the people, not reading their own will into the law. Thanks.
Mr. Herbert.
I first ran against my opponent, Justice Rice, because he didn't believe in free speech. If you look at the State versus Dugan case, you'll know what I mean. But around the time of the primary, I got a call from one of his supporters, apparently from Shelby. He said, "Why are you running against Jim Rice?" I said, "Well, I'm running against him because he didn't believe in free speech. Check the State versus Dugan case. He was the only one that thought you should be fined $600 and put jail six months for saying two nasty words to a county employee. I didn't think I was right. The other six justices didn't think I was right either." But then he said, "Oh, it had nothing to do with the Barry Beach case." I said, "Well, I read about the Barry Beach case. It looked like he should have gotten a new trial." "Well, I heard a whole bunch of reasons why he shouldn't have gotten a new trial." And he said, "Well, I thought maybe you were running against him because he wrote the court's majority opinion." "Well, I didn't know that. So I better look that up." And I looked it up. By golly, he did. And a couple things came to mind. About legislating for the bench and enforcing every law in this country, as I said in the beginning, when they threatened to put my grandfather in jail with the law because he helped his farmer friend who happened to be Japanese when he went to concentration camp, every law in this country that has been passed in the last 200 years is not fair and just. And I would certainly not enforce an unfair and just law, an unconstitutional law. I believe in the Constitution. These other people believe in a rule of law, which our founders, you find, were very suspicious of. They were not suspicious of our unable rights. But anyway, so let's get back to the Barry Beach case. So I read the Barry Beach case, and the first thing I saw there that Jim Rice actually graduated from high school, even though he was born and raised in Canada, he actually graduated from high school in Glasgow, at the small town where the trial was held. First thing I said in my letter to the editor, which was published in several papers, including the Billings Gazette, "This gentleman should have recused himself from this case from the beginning. He should have never had anything to do with the Barry Beach case in any way, shape, or form." Anytime it came to the Supreme Court, and it came to the Supreme Court about a half dozen times, I believe. I called the ruling fundamentally flawed and essentially illegal. Fundamentally flawed because they didn't follow appropriate appellate procedures that are accepted in every state. And they ruled, supposedly by reason of law, on issues that should have been, that were found in the trial court, they are credibility witnesses that should not have been ruled on by an appellate. And essentially illegal because if you read Brian Morris's opinion, he goes over it very well. Very well written, very well thought out. And if you want to read it, 9 pages of it, it'll explain what I'm talking about in 9 pages. But it was essentially illegal because they didn't follow their own rules or their own law of the case in the case they had established. So that's why I call it essentially illegal. Again, I'm not into enforcing unjust and unfair laws. We have a bunch of them in this country. And until the judges start recognizing them, we're still going to be in trouble. And I believe that the jury should be properly informed in this state, and they are not. We'll get to that later.
So I'd like to turn now to the preamble to our Constitution. "We, the people of Montana, grateful to God for the quiet beauty of our state, the grandeur of our mountains, the vastness of our rolling plains, and desiring to improve the quality of life, equality of opportunity, and to secure the blessings of liberty for this and future generations, do ordain and establish this Constitution." Like this extraordinary preamble, Montana's constitution and laws are distinctly ours. Even when applying legal text that is nearly identical to federal law, the Montana Supreme Court has chosen not to march lockstep with the interpretations of the United States Supreme Court. When would you depart from the established interpretations of other courts, and why? Justice Sweet?
Western Traditions Partnership is the first case that comes to mind. And Justice Rice has already talked about it. I want to talk about it just a little bit. As you're all probably aware, Citizens United essentially has given corporations the rights of personhood and stripped away Montana's right to regulate corporate political spending. In that case, the district court found the statute at issue to be unconstitutional because of the Citizens United case. And I was proud to sign my name onto the majority opinion that reversed that district court case because I felt like the statute was supported by history of corruption at all levels of government in the state of Montana. Corporations were still not completely barred from participating in the political process because they could form PACs. And more importantly, as we stated in our opinion, the state of Montana has a compelling interest in protecting and preserving an independent, fair, and impartial judiciary. So that's the one case where I was happy to not march lockstep with the United States Supreme Court. But it goes beyond just the United States Supreme Court. There are sister jurisdictions that have rulings, that have statutes, there are federal statutes. And our court, in numerous cases, are always looking to the federal law or opinions from sister jurisdictions to help us make decisions in the cases that are brought to us. So I think, even though we have an independent streak, we still look at other courts and their decisions to help us make decisions that are right for Montanans.
Mr. Van Dyke.
So my general approach to interpreting Montana law is going to be the approach is, in State versus Bonner, a 1950 case from the Montana Supreme Court. It says judicial power is never exercised for the purpose of giving effect to the will of the judge, but is always exercised for the purpose of giving effect to the will of the people as that will is expressed in the law. Sounds pretty straightforward. It's, I think, what we all believe. It's what probably most people believe out there, the normal, ordinary Montanans. And in figuring that out, what the will of the people is as that will is expressed in the law, it can be very helpful to look to other states. So, I did that, and I'm sure you saw Anthony as the state solicitor all the time. You know, Montana is a smaller state, so it doesn't have as well developed a body of law as some other states that have a lot more population. So we would, you look to other states to see how they've ruled, because a lot of times a question you have has never been decided by the Montana court, especially the Montana Supreme Court. So you do that all the time. And it's always helpful, of course, to get the wisdom and of other judges and other jurisdictions. But I do want to note that I don't think that it works very well as a way to try to constrain what I talked about earlier, results-oriented judging. You guys have probably heard about Justice Scalia. He doesn't like legislative history, and the reason is the picking your friends problem, right? He says that if you use legislative history, the problem is you go through it, it's like looking over a crowd and you pick your friends. You go in legislative history, you pick out the stuff that fits what the result you already want, and you say, see, legislative history supports my position. And that is a big problem. It's also a big problem with trying to use other jurisdictions' law. There's a tendency, I think, to try to pick, if you want to engage in results-oriented judging, there's a tendency to rely on the other jurisdictions that support you and not the ones that don't. And a good example of that is, again, my case. When they challenged and asked whether I had been admitted to the practice of law for 5 years. The big question was, what does admitted to the practice of law mean? 10 other jurisdictions had all addressed that question in various formats, the state bars, the Supreme Court, et cetera, and all arrived at the conclusion that somebody who had inactive status was still admitted to the practice of law. No states had determined otherwise. The Kansas Supreme Court had decided a case that said that somebody who'd been suspended from the practice of law was not admitted to the practice of law. So, of course, that was a case that my opponents grabbed a hold of, and the people that ruled against me grabbed a hold of. It's the looking out of the crowd and grabbing your friend's problem. So, I mean, nothing's going to stop a judge who's results-oriented from reaching the result they want, going out and picking some jurisdiction that supports them. It's really important that when a judge comes to a case that they have, first and foremost, that I'm going to try to figure out what it is the will of the people in the Constitution or in the law. What is it that the people wanted, and apply that, not try to read their own views into that. So,
Mr. Herbert.
Yes. I noticed people are dropping names here, and I wasn't going to do this, but I was fortunate when I was in law school to have Anthony Kennedy as a constitutional law professor. I'm also a third cousin of Learned Pan. But I want to get to the point here, and the point is that the criminal law system in Montana is not just. I have represented over 300 people for the California Parole Board who are seeking dates and life sentences or seeking parole dates. I did that to gain legal experience. I was 40 years old when I started law school. 44 years old when I finally was admitted to the bar. And I had another doctor attorney friend of mine who I was working with. I worked with several doctor attorneys when I first started out. He said, Dave, why don't you become a Board of Prison Terms attorney and represent people for the parole board. You get really good legal experience. You have to go over reading information, prepare yourself for a 2 or 3 hour hearing. It's kind of like a mini trial. So I did that. But in so doing, I was become very familiar with the criminal justice system. We do not have a good criminal justice system in Montana. The problem with it is there's hardly any justice for a lot of people. When you can be sentenced to 31 days confinement for raping a 14-year-old girl, or life without parole for almost the same thing, we have a disparity in sentencing here, which is atrocious. And I think that's one of the things we could look to other states for to see how they do it. And that might be a good thing for us to look for, is see what they're doing and see what's more just, possibly. And interestingly enough, I thought I had an appointment to see some of my fellow Vietnam veterans and other combat veterans at Deer Lodge tomorrow. And I had it all set up, and apparently somebody is saying, oh, no, we can't do that. Although I did talk to the veteran representative at Deer Lodge, the inmate that represents the veterans, a couple weeks ago in person. But the criminal law system here really, really needs some help. And again, I know that every law and every statute on the books is not fair and just. And, I'll tell you, I'll go into that a little bit later, but again, I think judges in this state should also properly inform instruct juries. It's on my website. You can read that. And I will go over a case here in my last 3 minutes that I will talk to you about and explain to you. But we definitely could be looking to other states and maybe the federal jurisdiction for some guidance, and particularly the criminal law system. Also, I will talk about later by a chance. I have been an expert witness before juries in 3 different states, and we have a situation now where we have very politically motivated experts, and it's becoming a real problem. And our present judges can't handle it because they just found out political science isn't a real science, and that's what they took to college.
Justice Rice.
Our court has been very clear about the point at which we start constitutional analysis under our state constitution, in that we don't march lockstep with the federal constitutional law, but we apply our own independent analysis. That doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that we will end up at a different place. If you study our constitutional history, sometimes it is developed that our state constitutional right is very similar to or even identical to the federal constitutional right. Sometimes that's not the case. In the case, for example, the right to privacy, we have a state textual provision that has no comparable provision under the federal constitution. Other rights, for example, like the right to counsel, our delegates at the Constitutional Convention very specifically said, we like the federal provision. We want to match the federal provision in the state constitution. And so although you start from a position of knowing that we don't march lockstep, the analysis takes you to the result depending on what you find in our constitutional history. Our outside of constitutional law, that can be very different. For example, in the human rights area, our Human Rights Commission enforces a state law that looks to federal law for guidance. So sometimes the law is very specifically set up so that we look to federal law to give us an indication of where we should be going under state law. So it really depends on what area of the law that you're talking about. When I came to the court 14 years ago, it was a very different court than it was today. And this is probably an area where I've carved out a niche. But 14 years ago, the well-respected and long-serving lawyer for the legislature, who is well-known and liked across both sides of the aisle, took the dramatic step, extraordinary step, of calling the court out publicly and for violating separation of powers, for being an activist court that decided cases or issues beyond those raised in the case, for being too quick to strike down legislative enactments. And that wasn't just one person's opinion. That was an opinion that you could find both inside and outside of the state of Montana, that the Montana Supreme Court was pretty far out there. And what I've tried to do, and this relates to, you know, following the law and following precedent, is to restore a more traditional jurisprudence to the court, what I think is a correct jurisprudence, being very careful about individual roles of the government, being very careful about separation of powers, only striking down legislation when it's clearly necessary to do so, and giving other branches of government the room in which to operate within their spheres of government. And I think we've made some very good changes today, and rarely do you hear any more criticism of the Montana Supreme Court as an activist court. And I think that's important for the years ahead.
Let's turn now to the Declaration of Rights in the Constitution and a couple potentially conflicting provisions and values. Article 2, Section 28 addresses criminal justice policy. Explains that laws for the punishment of crime shall be founded on the principles of prevention, reformation, public safety, and restitution for victims. Meanwhile, the Declaration of Rights provides extensive protection of criminal defendants' rights beyond the federal Constitution. In these judicial campaigns, as with most, we hear candidates generally support the rights of criminal defendants. And as with most judicial campaigns, we hear candidates criticize as dangerous specific decisions purporting to vindicate those same rights. Should a Supreme Court justice balance the rights of the accused against public safety in deciding cases? Why or why not? Mr. Van Dyke.
So I want to respond to something that Jim just said. I agree with Jim that was the reputation as somebody who is from the Montana and has been outside the state for a period of time. That was the reputation of the Montana Supreme Court. I also agree with Jim that he has been a huge influence for helping that reputation. I guess I would disagree with him that the court does not still have a lot of that reputation. Our court does. And so that's exactly why I'm running. You know, I don't have a political background. I don't, I think there'd like to be a conspiracy theory out there about, I'm a Montanan who came back home, worked in state government, and wants to make sure we have a rule-based court, a court that follows the law, a court that isn't answerable to special interests. So on the question about the question about criminal law, the most important thing about criminal law that you need to have is predictability. I think that is what in balancing all this stuff, you have to have predictability both for citizens so they can know when they're violating the law and when they're not violating, know what the balance of the law, and so you can have predictability for law enforcement. You know, I think we heard Justice Sweet talk earlier about, well, you know, he kind of saying, well, we make decisions as the entire court. Well, not all the time. Sometimes there's dissents. Justice Sweet was a lone dissenter in a case involving a woman who was caught shoplifting. And so she had a warrant out for her arrest. So they took her back, incarcerated her. And then just as pretty much every other jurisdiction in America does, they searched her purse. It's called an inventory search. That had been decided by the Supreme Court some time ago, our Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court, but our Supreme Court heard that case again. I was involved in that case in the preparation for that in the Attorney General's office. Justice Sweet was the only dissenter in that case, the only justice that said that the woman's privacy rights trump the safety concerns for police officers and trump the safety concerns of the other inmates. Now, but more important than that, in that decision, Justice Sweet said, I'm not saying this is always going to be the case. We'll decide this in a case-by-case basis. Law enforcement will tell you that they need bright-line rules. They cannot be trying to figure out, well, what will the justices think of this particular case? You know, that's a big problem. And so I think that you have to have predictability. Predictability, it flies in the face of the results-oriented judging is what leads to unpredictability. It's when you say, you know, I think we should go this way. I got to write a decision to get there somehow, then you don't have predictability. When you have decisions that are based upon the will of the people as expressed in the law, when you have decisions based on repeatable legal principles, then you get predictability. And that's what Montana's Supreme Court has got a reputation as having a problem with, and that's what I would like to try to help.
Mr. Herbert.
As I said before, Vox Populi is not Vox Dei. That is the voice of the people. It's not the voice of God. Sometimes the people are wrong, and they pass laws that violate our constitutional rights. I remember listening to this reporter, Tim Rice's, around the time of the primary, tell me about Jerry Beach and they got a new trial. Well, basically what he's telling me, well, that there'd be witnesses that had died, there'd be evidence that was gone, blah, blah, blah. What he was telling me is that it would be unfair to the state to have a new trial. Well, who cares if it's unfair to the state? The state doesn't have any inalienable rights. We as individuals have our inalienable rights. And we have laws out there that really, really do not protect those rights. In fact, they infringe upon those rights. And we got to remember that. You know, the more we remember that, the better off we're going to be as individuals. We're not great because of democracy. We're not. There's nothing sacred about democracy. But there is something sacred about the Constitution our founders wrote. There's something sacred about the inalienable rights granted to us by our Creator, Thomas Jefferson said it, the Declaration of Independence. And we tend to forget that sometimes, I think, especially in the criminal justice system. The state does not have a lot of rights. It shouldn't have any rights. This person being tried, the person being accused of a crime, with all the resources of the state at hand, they're going against that individual person. And he has the rights. The state has something called responsibility. They have something called they have a burden. The state has a burden. It has rights. And these people, I think, forget that we don't balance things sometimes. We balance things too much. And that's where we get the criminal justice system we have in this state. We punish people with 31 days for rape or life without parole for rape. Where's the balance in that? There's no balance there. There's no justice there. And I've talked to a number of prisoners, because I'm used to talking to prisoners. I did 300 parole board hearings in California. I've visited a dozen prisons in California and several here and several other states. And I'm used to going to prisons and talking to inmates and prisoners. And there's some very unfair things that have happened to these people. And they didn't have the luxury of having Jerry Spence or some other lawyer who knows what the heck he was doing. They had a public defender who was 6 months out of law school. And that's the way it is. And that's the reason why our founders set up our Constitution the way it was, to protect our individual rights. And let's get out of this balancing crap. Protecting our individual rights is more important than balancing some of that stuff. I hear balance, balance, balance. I want to hear some balance in a criminal justice system, just like I said about the disparity in sentencing is terrible. And if I'm on the court, I will try to do something about it. I don't know if I'll ever be able to do something about it, but I'll give you my solemn promise. I will certainly give it my best shot.
Justice Rice.
The general answer to your question, Anthony, in regard to whether judges should balance the rights of criminals versus public safety is no. The judges are not called upon to make a determination of guilt or innocence with regard to whether this is a good idea for the individual versus a bad idea for the public. We really have to analyze rights in individual cases with regard to the constitutional rights of the defendant. There are a few exceptions in the law to that. For example, in front of the Sentence Review Division, the law specifically has been set up to balance both the defendant's right to a fair sentence and the public's right to safety. And that's why when you go to Sentence Review Division, if you've ever represented somebody there, you can file a petition for sentence review for a defendant. And guess what? You can have your sentence increased. That's a risk that you undertake. But that's one of the very narrow situations in which courts under the law have the ability to consider public safety in addition to the defendant's rights. The court's duty, I think, is illustrated best by an example, and this case came to mind earlier in response to some of the most difficult cases that we have had to decide. This case, State versus Aceto, was a case in which a man charged with two counts of attempted deliberate homicide and one count of aggravated kidnapping appealed his conviction to our court. He had overwhelming evidence of guilt, but there was a violation of his trial right to be present during the course of the trial. And we had to overturn, and an unanimous court overturned that decision and sent it back for a new trial. Very unpopular decision. The court took a lot of flack for it. And I understood that because it was unpopular with me, too. I didn't like the outcome or I didn't like the decision. But again, we weren't balancing against public safety or else we would have kept him in prison. We were enforcing rights. And I think that's what the court's duty is to do. I can't just let my opponent's repeated arguments with regard to jury nullification go by unanswered this evening. He believes the jury has the power to not enforce the law that's given to the jury by the jury instructions from the judge if they think it's just or unfair. So in other words, even though we elect representatives in our democratic society to go to Helena and pass laws, and we elect a governor to review those laws and decide to sign them and put them on the books, and we have courts to judicially review those laws and explain them and put them in a form that can be written down and given to juries, and we have judges decide which laws are applicable to the case, we're going to overturn that system. We're just going to say, jury, if you don't like this system, you don't have to enforce the law. And to me, in a word, that is subversion of the democracy.
Justice Sweet.
Thank you. I agree with Justice Rice. We don't make that balancing. You know, we hear lots of cases at the Supreme Court. I think it's somewhere between 350 or 400 just direct appeal cases every year. And half of those are criminal cases. Bear in mind, what comes to us is a set of facts that have been developed in the district court. We don't make up these facts. They're brought to us. And the lawyers argue on the basis of those facts. They argue legally their case to us in their briefs or in oral argument. And it's on the basis of those facts and those arguments and the confines of the Constitution, if there's constitutional issues raised, and statutes that are raised, that we make our decision. And so it's not like we're sitting around balancing public safety against the rights of the individual defendant, just as Justice Rice said. If under the facts and the law of a particular case, a case should be reversed, we will reverse it, regardless of whether we're going to catch flack for that. Likewise, if under a set of facts, if the case needs to be affirmed, we're going to affirm. You know, I wanted to, I didn't know if I'd get to this, but we just got from the court administrator's office, they did a bench bar survey, which was conducted in September. And it went out to a number of judges and lawyers and actually faculty members. I'm sure Anthony filled this out and sent it right back.
Anonymously.
Anonymously, of course. But 404 people returned it. And it all had to do with how do they perceive the court. And I just want to read a couple of things to you. On the basis of those, it says that the court continues to enjoy high rankings from those familiar with the workings of the court, attorneys, judges, and law faculty, averaging the responses to all statements. More than 85% of the respondents strongly agreed or agreed with the court's overall performance, and that 90% of the respondents believe that the court does a good job in issuing opinions in adversarial cases in a timely manner, and it goes on. My point here is that the people that are using the court system, the lawyers in the state, they have faith in it, and they recognize that we're doing a good job. And so all this result-oriented talk is just that. It's just talk and hot air, because the facts are the lawyers and the people that use the system are satisfied with what's going on.
For the last question, we'll turn to civil justice in Article 2, Section 16, the administration of justice. That provision reads, courts of justice shall be open to every person and speedy remedy afforded for every injury of person, property, or character. Notwithstanding these constitutional guarantees, many Montanans lack access to justice. What do you think is the primary barrier to access to justice in Montana, and what, if anything, should the Supreme Court do about it? Mr. Herbert?
The primary barrier is that there's no lawyers that are not available. It's probably a reasonable thing here because there's not enough lawyers in Montana. would imagine that'd be a good answer. But there's a problem with the civil justice system in general. I have been, as I said, I have functioned as an expert medical witness in front of juries in three states. And the problem I see these days in the civil system, whether you have an attorney or not, is the expert witness problem. We have highly politically motivated expert witnesses from both sides of the spectrum. And how do we get rid of that? How do we handle that? What do we do about that? Well, you know, we could probably pass legislation, but where does the legislation come? It comes from highly polarized legislation bodies of the state, well, state basically here. And they have a state house and you have a state senate. And I'm not sure what kind of legislation you get passed, but one of the things I would suggest to remedy this problem with the highly politicized experts we have is that we have more people like me who have been experts who understand where basic science, the procedure of a basic science, like calculus and physics and chemistry and all of that. I think one other candidate might understand that himself. But the average justice on the trial courts here, or on the Supreme Court, what did they major in college? Political science. You know, when I was going to law school, I figured out political science. I only had one course in political science in college. Political science is not a real science, because the people who major in political science, comprised about 90% of my law class, were the people who didn't like chemistry and physics in high school or college. And you have to have a grounding in that to really understand what the expert is doing in that stand. If you can't understand that, you're gonna declare anyone an expert. Of course, in my case, if you're a licensed doctor, you pretty much are an expert. However, in some of these areas, a judge has to be able to determine who the experts are, because the judge, the person in the black robes, is the gatekeeper, whether it's for evidentiary procedures, and that's evidence is expert evidence, for example. They're the ones that determine who gets to testify about what, and they should have some grounding in the basic process of science. And a lot of don't. I think this is one area where we could put more people on the appellate courts and the trial courts who do have a grounding in science. And I'm giving you that opportunity as someone who does that, have that grounding. And that's one reason why you should look at me as a candidate, because you have that power. You are my jury. The jury for me right now is the 200,000 or 300,000 voters are going to vote for the fourth, I guess it is. I'm used to talking to juries. I've talked to a lot of juries. My wife said, don't get angry, just pretend like you're talking to a jury. I've tried to do that tonight. That's one of my suggestions for the civil side of the case.
Justice Rice.
We see a sizable issue in Montana, as other states do, with regard to access to justice. 70% of our domestic cases tried in the district court have at least one party who is unrepresented. And you think about that being the most difficult and stressful time of a person's life, and they also have the additional stress of trying to figure out how to represent themselves in court. 30% of cases that come before our court involve at least one party who is not represented by counsel. Those numbers are growing at steady paces. I think we generally believe the cause is what is the growing economic phenomenon of the shrinking middle class, where the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and the middle class is becoming smaller and smaller. More people are without the resources that they need to hire counsel and to have representation in court. The court is engaged in a number of efforts to do what it can to alleviate this problem. Of course, our efforts to encourage pro bono work, lawyers who give services either free or at a reduced rate, has been very, very successful. We just got the report counting the numbers for calendar year 2013, and Montana lawyers gave away, if you will, last year, legal services in the amount of $20 million to Montanans who were not served with legal counsel. That is really a commendable number, and I'm just sobered by the thought of that, because that is higher than it's ever been in the past. The court has taken the lead in setting up self-help law centers around the state of Montana. This is to provide forms and information to people who are representing themselves in court. And actually, we got started on this prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in 2011, which specifically recognized these kinds of efforts and approved them for litigants who are not represented by counsel. In the past, we were a little bit nervous about creating the impression that we're trying to unduly help somebody because we can't represent or be an advocate for somebody. But the court has said, no, it's okay to provide information and these kinds of services to unrepresented people. And so the court, our court now has taken the additional step of changing the rules that govern judges' behavior, the Code of Judicial Conduct. It's always said in there in the past, you know, that you can't help one side or the other. You had to be unbiased. Well, we've explained now that that doesn't mean that you can't provide informational assistance to a pro se litigant to help them through the process. What the U.S. Supreme Court has said is that the fairness of the process to a unrepresented litigant is a due process issue. This is a constitutional issue. This is a bigger problem in our society, and it needs to be addressed as a constitutional issue. And so we are doing all we can at our level to promote information and services to help people through the litigation process.
Justice Wheat.
Thank you. Justice Rice is absolutely right. This access to justice issue is reaching crisis proportions. Well, let me just read again some more statistics. Again, this is from the court administrator's office. In 2013, in the Montana Supreme Court, there were 860 filings. In the district courts across the state, there were 52,449. And in the courts of limited jurisdiction, there were 263,246. That's the volume of business in 1 year that our court system, from the Supreme Court down to our courts of limited jurisdiction, undertook in 2013. Now, Jim talked about the things that the court is trying to do to help out, and we are doing everything that we can. But the bottom line comes down to this. The Montana judiciary is funded by the legislature. And if you look at the total budget for the state of Montana, I think that the judiciary is 2% or less of that. And really what it boils down to is we need more money. You can have all the self-help help centers around the state that you want, but you need somebody who's trained and qualified to help these pro se litigants through the process, especially in the divorce area. As Jim said, that's where we're seeing most of that. So it's lack of funding. It's that, in my mind, is absolutely critical. And it's not going to be the court that completely solves the problem. It's got to be a joint effort between the legislature and the courts, because there are ways to solve the problem. You know, the Constitution provides everybody in our state with a remedy, and that they'll have a court to go to seek justice or damages if they've been harmed. But if they can't get into the court, then, like Jim said, it becomes constitutional. Another thing that happens is that the courts, when you have this volume of business, the court just gets clogged up. And so then the legislature passes bills that say gives priority to certain kinds of cases that the courts have to deal with before anybody else. So it really gets clogged up, and it's becoming quite a crisis.
Mr. Van Dyke.
So this is where I go off script and probably going to get in trouble with my campaign people. But, you know, Justice Wheat says he's left his partisan past behind him. But when he's, you know, he sounds like a Democrat when he says we need more money. So I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know, access to justice is an issue, and it's not just an issue for people who, you know, for lowest income people. As somebody who worked in a small business for years in Montana, you know, we couldn't afford to bring a case to trial either. You know, we had a small construction business, and if we ended up in, it's an issue that I don't know that it has any permanent solution that we can fix through the courts or through the, but it's just something that, you know, I'm glad that the court encourages pro bono. That's something that when I was working in private practice, I devoted a significant amount of my time to doing civil rights cases on behalf of people from the U.S. Supreme Court and federal courts to try to help people with, defend their civil rights. So that's one thing we can do to try to help access to justice. Fundamentally, though, I think the main job of the court is to be a just court. And to be a just court, it needs to be it can't be a results. You can't have results-oriented judging. And I'm not saying, I'm not saying that the majority of judges and justices in Montana are results-oriented. I have a very high opinion of the majority of judges and justices in Montana. But I think you do need to look at, if you don't have a predictable court, and a predictable court comes from having a court that follows the law, that is going to encourage more litigation. It makes it difficult for people to settle out of court because if you had a perfectly predictable court, nobody would bring a lawsuit, right? Because the transaction cost of a lawsuit would cause you to decide to just settle out of court, And so when you have an unpredictable court, it causes more litigation. And predictability is a result of having a court that doesn't unpredictability is a result of having a court that doesn't rigorously follow the law. So I think that the most important thing is that we actually have justice. And I think that needs to be the main focus of the Supreme Court, is to make sure that we are deciding cases in a fair and impartial manner, and that we're not trying to tilt the law one way or the other. That's the job of, legislature's job is to set policy. It's the court's job to apply the law. And again, I'll just read this case. Since you're all law students, I want you to remember this. The purpose of the judicial power is to give effect to the will of the people as that will is expressed in the law. That's the main job of the court. That's justice. Thanks.
So to close, we have an opportunity for you to sum up your judicial philosophy for the voters. And the closing remarks will start with Justice Rice.
Well, thank you, Anthony. I just want to thank everyone for coming tonight and participating in the forum. And appreciate this opportunity to express our views and have public discourse. I guess I'll just start with something that is really simple, but I think it's really important, and that is how important elections are to the Montana Supreme Court. I think they're really, really important. These positions don't get a lot of publicity. They don't get a lot of coverage in terms of the races or campaigns. The campaigns aren't funded with a lot of money that we can be on TV every night, like the U.S. Senate campaigns or something. And so a lot of times the public doesn't have a lot of information about them. But at the end of the day, almost virtually every issue you are concerned about will end up before the Montana Supreme Court for the final say on whether that is a valid principle or not, whether a statute is constitutional, whether the other branches of government have acted in accordance with their constitutional privileges. And at the end of the day, the most important thing that judges do is to protect the constitutional rights of the citizen. We sometimes get lost in the discussion about that, but at the end of the day, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Rights, our most important duty is to make sure those rights are protected for this generation and for the next. The most important issue in the campaign election between myself and my opponent is experience. It is the issue of preparedness. Which candidate is best qualified, is most capable of serving the people of Montana by careful analysis of Montana law, by serving as part of the leadership of the judicial branch? Who is most qualified? And I would just encourage everyone tonight who is listening or here to think about what you've heard and seen tonight and make your decision on Election Day with the best interest of the state of Montana in mind. Thank you.
Justice Sweet.
Thank you, Anthony. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I agree with Jim. Probably the most important thing here in not only my race and Jim's race, but any race for a judicial position is that experience matters. And in that regard, I would urge you to compare my experience, both in life and as a lawyer with Mr. Van Dykes. I mean, it's fairly obvious that he's pointing the finger at me and accusing me of being result-oriented and all these other things. It just simply isn't true. The statistics that I read to you from the court administrator's office about how satisfied the practicing bar and other judges and the law faculty are with how the Supreme Court is operating is telling. Those are facts and statistics that you can sink your hands and your teeth into, and they're not, I didn't create them, nobody. They were generated by the court's office. You know, I didn't get to finish talking about my background, but after I graduated from law school here at U of M in 1978, my first job was as a criminal prosecutor in Deep Silver. And I remember one case that I worked on there where we prosecuted a 72-year-old woman for homicide, and we won the case. Part of the reason, one of the reasons I'm bringing this up is because I learned a lot in that case. I remember the woman, she was known and viewed as Dirty Mouth Jean. That gives you an idea of what kind of a life she led. But she came into the courtroom and she was dressed like a little grandmother, and she daubed her eyes at just the right time and tried to be sorry. But, you know, she really wasn't, and she wasn't a grandmother. And to this day, I believe that if she had just been herself, been Dirty Mouth Jean, she might have had a chance of winning, but we convicted her. And what I took away from that is that people have to be who they are. I have a record. You can go look at everything that I've done with my life, and I encourage you to do that. And I am being who I am. I'm not ashamed of serving in the legislature. I'm not ashamed of anything in my past. Go look at my record and then make a decision on election day about who you think is in the best position to represent the people of Montana on the Supreme Court. Thank you.
Mr. Van Dyke.
I do thank you very much for listening. This is such an important, so important for Montanans too. And I hope that a lot of people are watching this because it's important for Montanans to know the judges that are, the candidates that are running for justice. I also agree that experience is very important. And if you look at the difference in experience between Justice Wheat and myself, you know, my experience is a decade of doing appellate and constitutional litigation, of trying to get the law right. That's what I've done my entire career. You know, Justice Wheat's career, he's older than I am. He's got a longer career than I have, but he has been a Democrat legislator, ran for Democrat offices, and been a trial lawyer for his entire experience. And that's fine. That's, you know, it's not, the problem, in my view, is not that he's a former Democrat legislator or that he's a trial lawyer. It's whether or not he judges that way. And I think if you look at his record, you will see he judges that way. I'll give you one example of that. The Montana, you know, he cited he's saying the courts and the lawyers, the judges and the lawyers are really happy with our court. I don't know whether that's true or not. I know the Montana Chamber is not happy with Justice Wheat. They endorsed me when I was still thrown off the ballot, which is something if you think about it. Endorsing somebody when they're Justice Wheat got a 42% rating from the Montana Chamber, double digits below anybody else on the chamber. On the court. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that somebody should get what number they should get from the chamber. I would suspect it's probably a bad thing if somebody got 100% rating from the Montana Chamber, because they represent a pro-business slant, and that's fine. The issue is when you're that far out of the mainstream, you're a former trial lawyer, and the question is that influencing your decision-making? And I think it is influencing his decision-making. I guess I would also urge that you do pay attention in this race and see how much money the Montana trial lawyers end up dumping in this race. There's going to be a lot of people crying foul about money in this race, but I would expect the Montana trial lawyers are going to dump six-digit figures in this race, and so just make sure that you have your hypocrisy filter on when you hear people crying foul about. Honestly, you cannot run against a former trial lawyer, against somebody supported by the trial lawyer bar in Montana, when you can only raise a small amount of money on your own. So do the math. I hope the people in Montana are paying attention. I really do hope they're paying attention, because I want this to be a court that the people of Montana are informed about, that they choose. It is very important. Justice Rice was absolutely right. This is critically important. It's much more important than maybe a lot of people realize. And I hope that Montanans are paying attention. I look forward to it.
Mr. Herbert.
Yeah, what was it? 3 weeks ago you were on the Voices of Montana, Justice Rice? Well, I remember he was on the Voices of Montana, and they called the day before and said, your opponent's going to be on the Voices of Montana. And when I call up and ask him a question, you're free to do so. So one of the first questions that was asked after he was interviewed was, why do the judges in this state not tell juries the whole story? We're talking about criminal cases. Civil cases, the judges have complete control of the outcome. But in the criminal case, judges will tell them they must find the defendant guilty if these elements of the crime were proven by facts. And the jury's job is only to determine the facts. Well, I asked Justice Rice 3 weeks ago if he remembered or heard of the case of the State versus Koch, spelled K-O-C-H. It's 33 Montana Reports 490. In fact, I went over and looked it up to make sure the case book was still there. And it's still there, and it's right there. And I didn't look up Pacific Reporter, which is 85P272. I would imagine that's a good site there, too. 1906. And that's right. Justice Rice said that, in ancient times, the jury had the power to judge the law. Ancient times. Yeah, he said ancient. But let me read you the pertinent part of this case. It was decided by the Montana Supreme Court. It has nevertheless always been recognized in practice in this jurisdiction, meaning Montana, that the jury has the power to disregard the law as declared and acquit the defendant, however convincing the evidence may be, and that the court or judge has no power to punish such conduct. This is what our founders meant by a trial by jury in the Sixth Amendment. You have the complete control. Now, this doesn't mean you're invalidating the law. It just means you're not applying the law to this defendant this time. You may think it's unfair or unjust to apply this law, or you may think the law itself is unfair or unjust. Everything passed by our legislatures, including federal and state, everything passed by them is not fair or unjust. If you think that, then God bless you. But I like I said, that's why I gave the details of my grandfather. When I said there was a law passed saying he could be sent to prison because he helped his Japanese friend in a time of need, and I think I was very unjust and unfair. But also, I also know that a jury does not have to apply that law if they're properly instructed by judges. And all a judge has to say, instead of saying you must follow, that you must convict, say you may. And then if you really have a real reason not to, well, think it over real carefully and not apply it the same. But anything you do here will not affect that law in the future at all. It's not really nullification. Only the judges call it nullification. I don't believe in it.
Well, this concludes tonight's forum, and it's appropriate that we're in a classroom because I think we've just had a very educational discussion. And I'd like to thank our candidates for coming here.